Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's wonderful to see so many of you here. For those of you who are new to CSIS, I'm Tasey Schaefer. I direct the South Asia program at CSIS. But I am welcoming you here not only on my own behalf, but on behalf of Dr. Stephen Cull, who is still putting the finishing touches on the arrangement of his papers. The presentation itself has been in great shape for ages. Steve is the director of the program on International Policy Attitudes and worldpublicopinion.org. The material that we're going to be presenting this afternoon actually belongs to PIPA and World Public Opinion. Thank you. And represents some fascinating polling that has been done in India and Pakistan on attitudes towards Kashmir. An issue that has been shoved way to the back of the stove because of more pressing and violent things taking place mostly in Pakistan, but which needs to be somewhere in our minds because it's still, after all of these years, is a very important factor in shaping the future of the subcontinent. I am not going to take any more of your time. I will turn the proceedings over to Clay Ramsey, who's the research director and who worked on this project, to Steve Cull, and to Christine Fair, who is going to comment on the results but who also was involved in the project. And I know it will be a very stimulating afternoon. And Steve, the floor is yours.
Okay, well, I don't really have anything to add right now. This is a project that we did in conjunction with the U.S. Institute of Peace. Originally, at least the Pakistan side was, and then later we were able to ask corresponding questions in India. So I'm going to pass it to Clay, and he's going to present the findings in India and Pakistan, and then I'm going to come in and show some data from another poll done by Colin Irwin from Liverpool University. Of polling done in Kashmir itself. It's just come out in the last few weeks. So, Clay.
Yes. All right. Well, this study was conducted in Pakistan and India at different points in the fall of 2007. In Pakistan, it was conducted in September 2007, so still under the League Q government, with 907 urban adults. The interviews were conducted at home in 19 cities of 10,000 or more. The margin of error is 3.3%. Then in India, this was done in two waves conducted over October and November 2007. There are 1,258 urban adults in the sample. The interviews were also face-to-face in 10 metropolitan areas, and the margin of error is 2.8%. Now, I'm going to show you questions asked to both publics in four broad areas. One is government performance on Kashmir in each country and on general Indo-Pakistani relations. Then, people's attitudes toward different possible final outcomes for Kashmir, Pakistani use of force to seek objectives in Kashmir. Some of these questions were addressed to Pakistanis only. And finally, the role of the United States. Now, we asked about general approval, but also whether people wanted their government to be more willing to compromise or if they felt that their government was too much that way already. And we asked whether you approve or disapprove of the way the country's government is handling the situation, that is, our country's government is handling the situation in Pakistan we said occupied Kashmir, in India we said Jammu and Kashmir. And the majority approval of each government is perhaps surprising. The minorities that do disapprove are about the same proportion in both countries. We asked how people felt about the prospect of compromise in the talks. Thinking about how the government has handled the problem in the last few years, would you say the government's been too reluctant to compromise with the other country, too willing, or has their cooperation been about right? And actually, there was no dominant view, but only 3 in 10 in either country look on their governments as too willing to compromise on Kashmir. Well, this raises the question, are those who disapproved of their government's performance on Kashmir, that's back in this question, are these a unified group? Do they all want less compromise, for instance? And so here they are. And as it turns out, they're not a unified group. So you're only looking at those Pakistanis who disapprove of their government's performance, and the minority of Indians who disapprove of their government's performance. And in each country, it's only about 3 in 10, even of this group, who say that they think their government is too willing to compromise on Kashmir. We then asked there about India-Pakistan relations in general. Please tell me whether you approve or disapprove of the way our country's government is handling relations with the other country, and with relations more broadly. Again, only about 3 in 10 disapproved of performance, though only a fifth in each country approved strongly. Then we asked about their sense of threat. Do you see tensions between India and Pakistan as a critical threat, important but not critical, or not an important threat at all to the vital interests of our country in the next 10 years? And exactly the same number in each country, 53%, said that they perceived the tensions between the two countries as a critical threat. So the threat perception is very similar and it's very definite. And yet, support for increasing defense spending just does not rise to the level of the apparent concern about the threat. So, again, curiously, the same number in Pakistan and India, 31%, only 3 in 10 say that defense spending should be expanded. Consequently, this is not really in gear with the perception of threat very strongly. Now, on views of final outcomes for Kashmir, the way that we proceeded was to ask about 6 scenarios, and for each one, we asked them whether they would find it desirable, acceptable, tolerable, or unacceptable. And so we want to emphasize, actually, how many find it unacceptable rather than simply how many support or oppose something. So for the first one, we just asked about what if Kashmir remains under Indian control in its present status. And so in brown, those who find something unacceptable are called out separately. And as you might expect, 7 in 10 in Pakistan say that continuing present status is unacceptable. But it's intriguing, I think, that only a quarter of Indians seem to be thrilled about the existing arrangement. So there is distinctly low enthusiasm for the existing situation. Then the next scenario would be Kashmir gains greater self-rule, but it's still inside India. And here, 2/3 of Pakistanis say, well, that would be unacceptable. But it is intriguing that a clear majority of Indians could live with the state of J&K as a more autonomous entity. All right, here are the next two. Kashmir is divided, and some joins Pakistan, and some joins India.
You're talking now about the Indian-controlled parts of Kashmir being divided, is that correct?
We are using the phrase to Indians, Jammu and Kashmir, and we hope that that conveys to the great majority of our respondents that we mean the borders of the state of Jammu and Kashmir within India. And we are, in speaking to Pakistanis, we say occupied Kashmir, and so we hope that we are clarifying that that means Kashmir under Indian administration. In Pakistan, openness to a division in territory is pretty slim. It's at about 37%. In India, there is also not a lot of interest for this, but fewer find it unacceptable, about 4 in 10. So the next one is Kashmir is jointly managed by India and Pakistan. And there is a little more openness among Pakistanis to the idea of joint management, which, of course, might be really the most abstract of all of these that we're proposing. But half in both countries do call it unacceptable. All right. Now, here we have Pakistanis' two favorite alternatives, and there's corresponding Indian resistance to one of them. Kashmir becomes an independent country. 53% of Pakistanis call that desirable, and more say that they could live with it. And in India, half say that this would be unacceptable. And then, of course, Kashmir becomes part of Pakistan. 60% of Pakistanis find that desirable, and a sort of mirror image, 61% on the Indian side say that that is unacceptable. We wanted to know how publics would react to the idea of a majority view among all Kashmiris on both sides of the line of control, even if this meant that both countries would lose territory. So we asked, suppose that the majority of all Kashmiris, including those on both sides of the line of control and refugees, want Kashmir to be an independent state. In that case, would you regard an independent Kashmiri state as desirable, acceptable, tolerable, or unacceptable? And actually, majorities in both countries described that as something that they could live with. You'll note that for Pakistanis, we're now including Azad Kashmir in this independence formula. So now only 21% call this desirable. In the previous question about independence, it was above 50%. And while Indian resistance is higher than in Pakistan, it's really only about a third, 35%, and a bare majority of Indians, 51%, are calling this at least tolerable. But then what do Pakistanis and Indians assume about the preferences of Kashmiris anyway? A little under half in each country, when they're asked, thinking about occupied Kashmir or Jammu and Kashmir, is it your impression that a majority of people there probably would prefer to be part of Pakistan, part of India, independent, or divide Kashmir so that some joins each country? A little under half in each country assume most Kashmiris want to be part of the respondent's own country. So in Pakistan, 47% say, well, they really want to be Pakistani. About as many, 45%, say they want to be independent. In India, a plurality, 45%, assume that they want to be part of India. And this same pattern holds up when it's the people of Azad Kashmir who are being asked about. In India, this was called Pakistan-occupied Kashmir. So 54% of Pakistanis think Azad Kashmiris want to remain in Pakistan, but 39% say they probably want it to be part of a larger independent Kashmir. And in India, again, a plurality think that Azad Kashmiris would probably like to be part of India. Now, I realize this raises the question of what Kashmiris, in fact, do want, and Steve is going to turn to this as soon as I'm done. All right. Now, a primary and classic justification for using force is naturally insecurity of one's compatriots or co-religionists. And issues with the security of Muslims in India can serve as an effective argument in Pakistan in favor of using force. So it is important to see how Muslim security is assessed by the publics. We asked, how effective would you say the Indian government is in assuring the safety and security of Muslim citizens of Kashmir? And a majority of Pakistanis thought that the Indian government was not very effective. And in India, a majority of Indians say the government is effective, but this is not an overwhelming conviction. It's 51% who say this, and 3 in 10 Indians do call the government ineffective. We ask the same question about the security of Muslims in India overall, and the Pakistani public makes a distinction because only 51% call the Indian government ineffective for Muslims throughout the whole country. Indian views, however, are just the same for the whole country as they are for Kashmir. Now, it was important for us to gauge public support in Pakistan for using force, so we presented 3 scenarios. Thinking about the part of Kashmir administered by India, for each of the following steps, please tell me if you would favor or oppose taking them in support of freeing it from Indian control. First, putting pressure on India by supporting militant groups in occupied Kashmir. Then adding more Pakistani army troops along the line of control and along the international border. And finally, our adventurous alternatives, the Pakistan army trying to take control and annex territory in occupied Kashmir and to annex it to Pakistan. Well, all 3 of these are answered in a very similar way. You have about 4 in 10 or less who say that they would favor this idea. You have a quarter who wouldn't, and you have a great many who would prefer to not answer the question, who show themselves agnostic. So this is not a very impressive foundation of public support on which to take risks. Then we probed further into Pakistanis' views on militant groups that try to operate in Kashmir. We asked, thinking about Pakistani militant groups that operate in occupied Kashmir, do you think that on balance they help the security of people in occupied Kashmir, hurt their security, or have no effect either way? And again, just 4 in 10 thought that these groups helped the security of Kashmiris. Many didn't answer. And then we asked, well, what about Pakistan's own security? And then this drops down to just 1 in 5. Only 20% of Pakistanis will say that these groups are of any value for the actual security of Pakistan. Now, here's a question we asked in both Pakistan and India. Do you think the Pakistani government does or does not give weapons and money to some militant groups that fight in the Indian-controlled region? And 4 in 10 Pakistanis said, no, that doesn't happen. A very small group, 13%, said it does. A very large number declined to answer the question. But in India, you have 47% who believe that, yes, this is happening. And then we ask the same kind of question in regard to groups that execute terrorist attacks anywhere in India. Just based on your impressions, do you think Pakistan's government is providing support or not to militant groups that conduct attacks against civilians living in India? And here you have a stronger negative coming from Pakistanis, a majority of 53% that say, no, this isn't happening. And another of these mirror image numbers in India, 53% saying, oh, yes, this support is being provided. Then to go deeper into how Pakistanis viewed violence against civilians for political purposes, we asked about a range of targets along a spectrum from military to civilian. In the context of the conflict in occupied Kashmir, for each of the following types of people, please tell me if you think that attacks against them are often justified, sometimes, rarely, or never justified. And among all 3 of these groups, Indian military, Indian policemen, and Indian intelligence agents, the answers are really the same. You have a plurality saying, no, this is rarely or never justified. And you have a smaller group that hangs at about 4 in 10 who say that this is justified. This seems to be, when you look at all these questions, a kind of upper limit for supporting violent means. Now, here are the next 3. And now we're getting into more directly civilian targets. when it's a matter of Indian government officials, there's a much stronger Pakistani majority rejecting this. And then we asked about wives and children of the military, because such an attack has been conducted in the past, and women and children generally, because we wondered if there might be a little difference. But no, they're both very roundly rejected by the Pakistani public and in exactly the same way. So, to the degree that Pakistanis know how some militant groups operate, they are going to experience a lot of discomfort with these groups' actions. Well, do Indians and Pakistanis presently see a constructive role for the U.S. to undertake? We asked, in the tensions between Pakistan and India, do you think the United States primarily takes Pakistan's side, takes India's side, or tries to be even-handed? And a clear majority of Pakistanis think the U.S. takes India's side. In India, a majority thinks the U.S. either is even-handed or takes India's side. So this raises an interesting problem, because if there's not a widespread perception that the U.S. is acting as an honest broker, how do these publics think that a U.S. that might just lean could affect them? We asked, please select whether you see closer relations between the other country and the United States as a critical threat, important but not critical, or not an important threat at all to the vital interests of our country in the next 10 years. And in Pakistan, a clear majority sees this as a critical threat, and quite a big majority sees it as at least a threat. In India, it's a little less strong, but still pretty vigorous, with 42% seeing it as a critical threat. So there's a suggestion of nervousness here about the U.S.'s possible footprint in Indo-Pakistani relations. And this may help to explain the low interest in each public for the U.S. to become more involved in trying to facilitate that relationship. We asked, how involved would you like to see the U.S. be in diplomatic efforts to improve relations between Pakistan and India? More than now, less than now, or about the same? And in Pakistan, you have a quarter saying, we'd like to see the U.S. more involved. In India, it's fewer than that. In each country, about a fifth say, well, couldn't it stay about the same as it is now? And in each country, about a quarter to say, well, perhaps it would be better for the U.S. to be less involved than now. Now, behind this may lie a low expectation that the U.S. will act responsibly. In this question, blue and green show low trust, and tan and brown show high trust. And as you can see, a majority in each country say they trust the U.S. not very much or not at all to act responsibly in the world. Let's compare this to the same question asked about China. Well, China's stock is pretty strong in Pakistan. In India, half don't trust China to act responsibly, but given the country's mutual past, this is perhaps not really a very bad rating. So does this mistrust of the U.S. go so far as wanting it to really withdraw from involvement? Well, this is a question that we've asked in the U.S. and in many countries around the world. It presents three possible modes of U.S. involvement. First, as the sole remaining superpower, the U.S. should continue to be the preeminent world leader in solving international problems, or the U.S. should do its share in efforts to solve international problems together with other countries, or the U.S. should withdraw from most efforts to solve international problems. And I'm going to start with withdrawal, which is on the right. In Pakistan, a quarter, and in India, 1 in 10, actually want the U.S. to withdraw more from involvement generally in the world. Then on the left, in blue, in Pakistan, 1 in 10, and in India, a third, want the U.S. to take on a preeminent role. So you have pluralities in both countries of about the same size that want an engaged U.S., but one that is more inclined to rely on multilateral frameworks. So I will conclude with that and proceed to Steve.
What stands out to me in the this presentation that Clay just showed is that Indians and Pakistanis actually show a bit more flexibility than their governments. Half or more do not reject a number of options such as independence or the division of Kashmir. But still, that's a large number that say it's unacceptable. What's particularly interesting, then, is that when the prospect of the Kashmiri people coming into the equation is presented, the numbers rejecting independence drop from about half to just a third or so in India. So you have a real possibility of greater flexibility if, one, you bring in the Indian publics and the Pakistani publics, but even more so if you bring in the Kashmiri public. So what do we know about the Kashmiri public? There has been, up until very recently, there was very little polling done in Kashmir, and what was done was really not adequate. It was quite patchy. Luckily for all of us, there was just recently a new poll done. It was directed by Colin Urban of the University of Liverpool and fielded by Team Sea Voter, the same group that did the fielding in India. He does something with that is called a peace poll, and you can see more about this on his website, peacepolls.org. And the methodology he has is that he goes to the region and he talks to leaders on both sides and develops, uses their language, uses their words to develop, formulate feelings, attitudes, and possible resolutions of the conflict. Gets the parties to in a sense buy into the questionnaire, and then runs it in a poll, and he's very careful to break out all the subgroups. He's done this in Northern Ireland. He's done this in the Middle East. He's done this in the Balkans, Sri Lanka, and so on. So in this particular case, the polling was done just in Jammu and Kashmir, or the three regions, the Kashmir Valley, Jammu, and Ladakh. The sample size was 2,000. There was an oversampling of Buddhists, Sikhs, and I don't know, Gujaris. Gujis. And it was done face-to-face and done March through May of this year. Just for those of you who are not entirely familiar, you can see these three areas of Jammu and Kashmir. Up in the upper left corner, the Kashmir Valley with Srinagar. Below it, the Jammu area. And then to the right, the Ladakh area. The breakdown in each of these areas in Kashmir, it's just over 3 million Muslims. 0.16 million Muslims in the Kashmir Valley, of 0.16 Hindus, and in Jammu, the 2 million Hindus, 0.9 million Muslims, and Ladakh, about 120,000 Muslims and about 130,000 Buddhists. So it's a complex little picture. But it's important. We're going to be breaking these different regions out as we go along. As you'll see, there are real important distinctions between them. So just looking at the aggregate numbers in Kashmir does not tell you the full story. So the poll includes a lot of material. I'm just going to look at a few key questions that looked at proposals for the final status. And similar to the poll we did, he offers the options that ask them whether the options are essential, desirable, acceptable, tolerable, or unacceptable, and the meaning of those each of those options is spelled out with a fair amount of precision. So,
how do people feel about the status quo? Well, not too good. In the Kashmir Valley, you have majorities saying that it is unacceptable, 58% of the Muslims, 73% of the Hindus. But in Jammu, it's the number saying that it's unacceptable or just tolerable is rather substantial. Is rather low. So in Ladakh, much lower. So you don't have in Jammu and Ladakh this uneasiness, this dissatisfaction with the present situation. But Kashmir Valley, you do have this quite high level of dissatisfaction. So let's look at some of the other options that were considered. Well, here's the big non-starter. Contrary to what the Pakistanis think, the idea of Kashmir becoming part of Pakistan just doesn't really get any interest going. These are the percentages who say that it's an unacceptable idea for Kashmir to become part of Pakistan like any other Pakistani province, and it's just firmly rejected. Well, we looked at what is the preferred outcome? What do people most want in each region? And that actually was a very clear story. In the Kashmir Valley, the most popular idea is for all five districts to become the independent state of Kashmir with responsibility for both their domestic and foreign policy and protecting their borders with Pakistan, India, and China, with large majority saying that's essential, and another 15 and 9% saying that it's desirable, and that's shared among Muslims and Hindus. So, real strong, clear consensus. None of the other options presented came close to this one. This is clearly what they prefer. Now, in Jammu, it's quite different. The most popular idea by a clear margin and for both ethnic groups is for all of Jammu and Kashmir to become part of India just like any other Indian state. And in Ladakh, pretty much the same story. Both Muslims and Buddhists, clear majority, say it's either essential or desirable for Jammu and Kashmir to become part of India like any other Indian state. So, is there something they can all agree on? Well, one thing it does seem that they can agree on is the idea of having a plebiscite. And we asked about the possibility of the people of Jammu and Kashmir, whether the people of Jammu and Kashmir should exercise their rights to a plebiscite in accordance with UN resolutions. And this is the whole breakout. And starting on the right, you see the number who say that's unacceptable. And in all groups, it's fairly small, with one exception, the Buddhists, who are almost entirely in Ladakh. Two-thirds of them say that that is unacceptable. From what I understand, their fear is that this could lead to Muslim domination and that they would not be well-treated in that context. But all of the others, all the other groups find it either essential or desirable, or at least acceptable. If you include those who say acceptable, it's a majority among all groups. Now, what about the option of autonomy? This is actually the one that gets the lowest number of unacceptable responses. Full implementation of Article 370 and return to the status existing in J&K before 1953, leaving only foreign policy to India. And on the right there, the brown bar, you can see how many say unacceptable. Once again, the Buddhists are the most resistant, with 61% saying that that's unacceptable. But for all the other groups, it's fairly small, but the Muslims in the Kashmir Valley, they're certainly not enthusiastic about it. You have 34% saying unacceptable, 16% just saying it's tolerable. What about the prospect of full independence, which is the one that the Kashmir Valley residents were most in support of. And not surprisingly, the in Kashmir Valley, as you see, is very, very large percentage in support. But a significant majority of Hindus in Jammu think that's unacceptable, and as do majorities, both Muslim and Buddhists, in Ladakh. What about the prospect of joining India as is most preferred but in Jammu and Ladakh? Well, in the Kashmir Valley, you have quite a lot of resistance to that, particularly the Muslims strongly opposed. Okay, well, what about, since they both seem to want different options, what about the possibility of each party deciding separately? And the prospect of all the districts of Jammu and Kashmir being allowed to decide their own future, how do people feel about that? Well, interestingly, there is no, in no group does a majority say that's unacceptable. You get some, particularly the Hindus in Jammu, where you don't get a lot of enthusiasm for the idea, to some extent, to some extent, it's a kind of consensus position. Now, it's easy to say that, but they don't necessarily know what the others would decide once those decisions became clear. They might have a lot of assumptions about what the other parties believe, just like the Pakistanis and Indians have a lot of assumptions about what the Kashmiris believe. So if it really came down to it, things might not flow that smoothly. Also, we don't really know how the Kashmiri Valley people would feel about it, because their focus is on the question that we asked was about an independent Kashmir in totality. We didn't ask about an independent Kashmir Valley. So clearly, there's still a process going on here. What we see that there are that there are some areas of consensus, areas of particularly around the idea of a plebiscite. The idea of autonomy gets substantial support. There isn't a clear-cut direction, but overall what we see here again is considerably more flexibility than you might predict from watching their leaders, particularly on both the Indian and the Pakistan side. So we think that it's probably a valuable thing to bring the voices of the people in India and Pakistan and Kashmir, to bring them into the table, because they do seem to express a significant amount of flexibility and a readiness to consider more options.
Okay. Thank you, Steve. And now let me invite Chris Fair to come up where people can see her, so she can give us her comments on.
I was going to wind up.
Oh, okay. All right. Any counsel on how to turn the interrogation light off here?
Well, I only have a few comments, and some of them are sort of unfair, because I've been seeing these data now for many months, and I could have asked you these months ago. So the one thing that I was thought that you might have an opportunity with these data, and so I don't know how the sample plays out, so maybe it's not possible. But for years, you often hear people talk about this alleged north-south divide, for example, in India, that folks in, say, Tamil Nadu don't necessarily care about the Kashmir issue. And I suspect that before Kargil, that may have been the case. But the Kargil war was sort of interesting, because it was sort of, it was for India, kind of like our 1991 Gulf War, in the sense that it was fully televised. For the first time, you had bodies, ashes coming back home. And so in Kargil, in many sense, the way in which that war was televised brought the conflict to places that previously it may have been kind of distant. So I was wondering if you had the opportunity, and if your sample would permit it, if you could actually look at geographical variation in views, I mean, sort of make sort of the traditional north-south distinction in your Indian sample. Similarly, you hear views of this nature espoused about Pakistan, that if you ask folks in Karachi what they think, Kashmir may be less relevant to them than, say, folks sitting in Lahore. And so this might be one of the few samples, because these questions don't get asked all that often of nationally representative samples of this size. So it might be interesting for you guys to take a look whether or not any of those hypotheses hold. More so than anything, I think the orthogonality of views across these samples wasn't all that surprising. What I was struck by were the views of Indians about the U.S. role. I suspect strongly, again, if you had asked these questions before Cargill, Indians would have been a lot less likely to believe that the U.S. either takes India's side or certainly an even hand. I think this has been one of the revolutions of the post-Cargill U.S.-India relationship, is that Indians are actually willing to embrace a role for the U.S. I think before, Indians would have been certainly less warm to U.S. involvement. So it was both the questions on the U.S. role in the world that struck me. And, of course, there's no benchmark. Unfortunately, you guys, I think, are the first to ask these questions. And then also the likelihood that the U.S. would play fairly in resolving the Indo-Pakistan dispute over Kashmir. I was really struck by those samples. Similarly, one of the results that has consistently disturbed me ever since we got these results back is that at first blush, the good news in this survey is that the overwhelming percentage of Pakistanis who chose to answer the question reject various forms of violence. And we only asked about, I think this only presented a subset. We also asked about the Taliban, Pakistan, Taliban, Al-Qaeda. This is just a subset of the questions that were posed. So the good news is the very large majorities simply found various militant actors and their activities to be unacceptable. But, you know, the disturbing underbelly is that one in three, actually, those are very large numbers in the scheme of things. And it really underscores, I think, this really interesting point of view that I think Pakistanis have. And this view comes out, even though our data now are coming up on a year old, there have been a number of polls, including the Gallup poll, that from their point of view, the U.S. is the biggest security risk, not these militant groups. I was struck by the Gallup poll that was released a few weeks ago. And all of these polls sort of generally point to this belief that despite what Pakistani policymakers and certainly all the military interlocutors that come through here to engage counterparts, that Pakistan does see this war as their own war on terrorism. What's very clear is that for Pakistanis, that's simply not true, that the threat that Pakistanis face is not sui generis because these militants impose a threat to Pakistan because the militant groups are dangerous. But there are various variations. So, for example, the U.S. is our threat. We're becoming under threat because of our alliance with the U.S. So while it's really encouraging that there is widespread rejection of these forms of violence, what's not encouraging is that you do have important minorities that don't reject that violence in totality. To sort of preempt some subsequent studies that Jacob Shapiro and I are doing, we ask the question, of these minorities of folks that do embrace violence to achieve their goals, what explains it? And, of course, we've heard throughout the last several years that it's things like poverty, that it's undereducation, that it's support of conservative Islam. I mean, some of you will remember during the elections the concern that if the Islamists were to win, that Pakistan would have a more receptive environment to militant groups. Well, we actually just did some good old-fashioned econometric modelings of these outcomes, and we were actually struck by what we found. These data don't have economic data, but because of the way we designed the survey, we could crosswalk it with data from the Household Economic Survey. So we have an idea of what the district-level economic environment looks like. And sure enough, when we found it didn't matter whether they came from poor areas or wealthy areas. It didn't explain any of the variation of support for militancy. Whether they embraced things like Sharia, that didn't explain it either. Whether they supported politically the Islamist organizations the Islamist political organizations, that did not explain the variation and whether or not you support different kinds of militant activities. What did explain it was politics. If the respondents espoused the goals and the political views of those militant organizations, they were more likely to support the use of violence. Another really interesting thing that came out of these data that we were really surprised by was that it was a very consistent sort of rational expectation of benefit. So if you take a look at those data, for example, supporting the use of proxies in Kashmir or in India, if respondents thought that India was doing better economically than Pakistan, they were far less likely to support the use of proxies. So in other words, what they're thinking through, if India is so much stronger to respond, then by supporting these groups, we're actually imposing more harm than good on both sides. And this was also true when we looked at support for militant groups operating in Afghanistan. So it's kind of out of the scope of this presentation, but it seemed kind of timely and really important to emphasize that we're talking about fixing madrasas, we're talking about secularizing, we're using a bunch of vocabulary to frame policy interventions that, based upon secondary analyses of these data, don't actually seem to bear fruit. Let me see if there's anything else that I wanted to say. To state the obvious, I was really surprised in the second set of polling data that you presented that when it came to espousing views about independence and the need for a plebiscite, the variation between Hindus and Muslims in the valley was actually really small. And I think, you know, having hung out, spent some time in Kashmir, I was really surprised by that. And I was wondering, is this a sample artifact because there are so few Hindus in the valley relative to Muslims? If you could, I mean, is this a real result or is this a sort of a statistical fooler?
I had some comments that I wanted to make, but if you wanted to respond to that specific question while it's fresh in everybody's mind.
The first, you need to understand that we have some information, but they did make sure that all of the subgroups, there was an adequate sample size to make meaningful conclusions, and thus they oversampled certain subgroups and so on. It didn't just show up in this one question; it showed up in a pattern of questions. So it's I would suggest it's probably reliable.
I wanted to comment on two specific aspects of actually both sets of polling. The first is the role of the United States. This polling was conducted, and here I'm talking about the material presented by Clay on attitudes in India and Pakistan. This was conducted at a time when attitudes towards the United States in the world and in Pakistan were at something approaching an all-time low, and attitudes towards the United States in India were very much higher than most historical comparison points. The questions about whether Indian publics considered the United States or China to be responsible actors in the world, I think those data are 2 years old, isn't that correct? This was done before the Chicago Council?
No, these were all done.
It was the same question but asked subsequently?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, so that's some of that was 2 years ago. My guess is it probably wouldn't have changed very much since then. But what's interesting about this, obviously the very high levels of antagonism in Pakistan towards the U.S. role are interesting and are quite different from what had been the standard Pakistani position. Traditionally, the Pakistan government, and I think the Pakistani public behind it, has wanted international involvement in Kashmir because this was a way of diluting the kind of power contest between Pakistan and India. India has not wanted outside involvement in Kashmir. They're bigger, they're the status quo power. The logic behind that is very clear. These results deviate from that to some extent, and I think that's interesting because even after Kargil, I mean, it's been 9 years since Kargil, and it's taken most of those 9 years for attitudes in Pakistan to shift from continuing to believe that internationalizing Kashmir is automatically beneficial to a somewhat more skeptical attitude. The second subject I wanted to comment on was all of these results dealing with preferences for a particular final status in Kashmir. They are fascinating. There's lots to think about, but I guess my basic message is don't read too much into this. First of all, it's very unlikely that people in any of the three areas where the polling was conducted are going to be able to decide this issue based on pick your one favorite solution. we aren't often given that opportunity in any political system, and it's less likely in one where, if there is ever a final solution, government-to-government negotiations are likely to be a critical ingredient, if not the critical ingredient. Secondly, it's interesting to think about the tenor of the discussions on Kashmir that have taken place at the official and quasi-official level. And basically, there have been three types of things going on. The first and the most productive has been back-channel discussions, and by back-channel, I mean envoys that are officially authorized but are not necessarily your standard foreign minister or similar official. These are still going on. They were begun by envoys of Musharraf and Manmohan Singh. They have been continued under the present government, or so we were told last week when the Pakistani foreign minister appeared at Brookings. What these have focused on is, to a large extent, a version of President Musharraf's four-point plan. Now, the 4 points of this four-point plan aren't always the same every time it's articulated. But the one that seems to have gotten the most discussion is this question of joint management. Now, joint management is actually, my view, a truly horrible idea. To have the governments of India and Pakistan have to interact every day on the subject that where each makes the other most furious is not a recipe for anything good. But the interesting thing is that in both India and Pakistan, among people who have been not participants in this dialogue but reasonably well informed about it, the assumption is that joint management can be watered down to mean something that is practical and significant but doesn't involve this kind of everyday driving each other nuts. Joint institutions of some sort, tourism, electricity, forestry, maybe some kind of parliamentary contact, this kind of thing. That's one of the things that's been discussed, and the other thing that's been discussed is what goes by the name of soft borders, or, as one person put it, making borders irrelevant. None of that appears in any of the final solutions that were discussed. The final solutions that were discussed have picked up the issues that have been part of the public debate for 60 years and, alas, have gotten nowhere for 60 years. So I find it interesting, this modest pragmatic approach obviously doesn't have much public resonance now. That's a clear result from your findings. The reason I say don't read too much into it is that if we ever reach the happy stage where officials are getting close to some kind of agreement that the officials can live with, they will then have to do an absolutely amazing sales job with their public. And if you go back to the starting point, which is relatively high levels of satisfaction in India with how the Indian government is handling things, in Pakistan with how the Pakistani government is handling things, I wouldn't rule out their being able to bring the public along for a solution that looked quite different from what the public thought it meant. But that makes it peculiarly difficult to figure out what is going to have public acceptability. And my final comment is that, unfortunately, in the very short term, none of us will have the opportunity to find that out, because neither Pakistan nor India has a government that is strong enough to be able to take risks, and they're certainly not going to get anywhere without taking risks. And with that thought, let me open the floor up to questions. Let me ask
Can
you,
I just
please.
Make one comment based on some things you said. This kind of data, you know, public opinion on potential resolutions, agreed, it's not going to happen that there's going to be a plebiscite and then they're just going to follow the public. But policymakers, leaders who are trying to come to a resolution, they have two things they have to consider. One is what kind of resistance are they likely to encounter, and this gives us some information to that effect. Another is, if they're interested in some resolution, they may be looking for cover. And public opinion does provide legitimacy for certain positions. Public, one's own public, and also the publics of the in Kashmir, as we found that both Indians and Pakistanis were willing or interested in giving the Kashmiri people some role in this. And so, if you have this kind of these kinds of voices coming into play, it can and a leader wants to move in a politically ticklish direction, this can help.
Let me ask you, when I call on you, please identify yourself and your affiliation, even if I know you, because maybe others don't. Stan.
Stanley Kovar with the Cato Institute. I want to follow up something that Christine highlighted, because I thought of all the slides, that one about the 30%. I mean, that's stunning, because total population is 160 million. 30% because you've got 50 million. That's a lot of people. And my concern there is if they are that willing to use armed force against Indian security forces, what percentage of that 30% would say, and we'd also be willing to use them against our own security forces if they get in the way? You know, in the sense that we're seeing the internal violence inside Pakistan.
Oh, well, we asked that, though. I mean, okay. I don't know if you guys have the results. It's in one of these presentations. What I thought was kind of interesting, because Jacob and I have been living in these data for the last several weeks. What is interesting is that the Pakistani public has a much higher taste for these groups and their activities when they are operating outside, as you would expect. When you talk about these groups operating internally, support obviously decreases. And similarly, ask about the Taliban in Afghanistan. Was it like one in three thought, or was it more than that, thought they were the most appropriate government in Kabul?
It was about one in three.
I think it was one in three. But when you ask them about the Pakistani Taliban, then it's a really different picture. And so you do see that in this sample, is that when they are operating outside of Pakistan, they have certain utility. But when we did ask about a whole series of groups about whether or not they were critical threats to Pakistani security, you know, you can imagine some guy shows up at your flat in Karachi, you know, ding dong, my name is Mahmoud, I'm doing a survey for EC Nielsen, I'd like to ask you about for support for Al-Qaeda. exactly. So, you know, instead, rather than asking a very difficult question, and what we were really interested in identifying is who are our allies, who shares the threat perception that these guys are bad news. So we asked the question, do you see these as a threat to Pakistan's own national security? You know, if so, critical threat, all the way down to no threat at all. And so again, you saw the same picture. Very large majorities thought that these characters were really bad news. But on those data, again, you still saw that magical number, anywhere from 20% to 30%, that didn't think that these guys were a threat at all. So I share with you, I find you can dilate upon the fact that there are so many allies that do share these concerns, but there are big numbers who really see the world very differently. And I think this is beyond the data, but I think we're sort of remiss if we don't sort of appreciate how the U.S. activities in these other theaters actually shape that threat perception. If you look at the Gallup data that were just released, more people think that the U.S. threatens Pakistan's security than does Al-Qaeda.
Yes, Trudy.
Trudy Rubin, the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Trudy Rubin, the Philadelphia Inquirer. I'd like to ask whether you also asked any questions or have any data about bettering relations with India, Pakistan in general, not specifically related to Kashmir. And along that, with that, the current Pakistani government, or at least the PPP and its leadership, seems to be quite committed to trying to do confidence-building measures with India not specifically related to Kashmir, and you probably had these conversations with the foreign minister last week, who has all kinds of plans for conferences on each side introduced by the foreign minister, businessmen, intellectuals, media. Do you think that if there's an effort by the leaders of the two governments to improve relations with the other side apart from Kashmir, that would likely rebound on any change of attitude towards policy in Kashmir or use of violence?
Well, there are, in fact, in the survey, a number of questions that don't mention Kashmir at all and are only about the tone of Indo-Pakistan relations in general. And there, too, one sees only minorities that are that view such confidence-building measures as have been attempted as going too far. So I don't see any danger signals in this poll for advancing further down that road. And I assume that in the whole Indo-Pakistani agenda, Kashmir might be the last thing to be affected. But nonetheless, you know, the impact might get all the way to the caboose eventually.
Raghuveer Goyal from India Globe and Asia Today. You have not asked people that as far as Pakistanis call Azad Kashmir or Free Kashmir, if they call it a Free Kashmir, let them be free and let's see where it will lead, what will happen. You think if Pakistan declares a Free Kashmir within Pakistan, because they already call Azad Kashmir.
By that, do you mean a scenario in which Pakistan would tell Azad Kashmir go be independent? Am I misunderstanding?
Yeah, because
you?
They call already Azad Kashmir. It's already Azad Kashmir. So
Yeah. You're right. We did not ask about that.
So what do you think if they declare what will happen, where it will lead?
Well, I think the chances of their declaring their independence are approximately zero.
And finally, that the Kashmir issue has been used by both sides for 60 years. What do you think will happen?
Some night, let's have a long cup of tea and settle that one.
I can add that I did do focus groups in Pakistan and asked them about, really kind of push them on this question of, are you really ready to give up Azad Kashmir as part of a larger resolution? Because initially their response was, an independent Kashmir would be fine if that's what the Kashmiri people want. And then I said, now, but wait a minute, now that excludes Azad Kashmir. And there was a pause and a clearing of throat, and then, no, that's okay. And then another, you've got to understand how hard that would be for us. I mean, gee whiz, it's sort of rude for you to even ask. But no, I think we could do that. And so there was a kind of disequilibrium in the room, though the initial response was positive because the whole notion of an independent Kashmir is attractive, and so the initial response was, we would put that on the table, but when you call attention to it, there's a little more discomfort.
Yes. Malou Innocent, Cato Institute. This question is actually for Tessie. You mentioned that the idea of soft borders is something that's kind of unfeasible, and also the idea of joint management. Do you thereby think that something kind of according to the Good Friday Peace Agreement of Northern Ireland would be also unfeasible? I know it's beyond the scope of this survey, but it's something that's been proposed by the parties.
I actually didn't say that soft borders were infeasible. I just said I didn't think that seemed to have a whole lot of public resonance at the moment, although I will say that the institution of bus services between the two sides of Kashmir seems to have been quite popular in Kashmir, reasonably popular in India and Pakistan at the start, and then with the passage of time, fewer and fewer people were traveling because bureaucratically it was very difficult to get the necessary paperwork done. So the significance of that initiative seemed to shrink as time went on. Do I think something like the Good Friday Agreement would be feasible? Something that drew on the ideas of the Good Friday Agreement might well be feasible. The guy who has written really interestingly about this is a fellow named Sumantra Bose. who is at London School of Economics. I found his analysis fascinating. But, you know, that's around several corners from where we are now. Lady in the white jacket here, and then the gentleman over there at the back of the room.
Hi, Samira. Thank you for that wonderful presentation. I just wanted to pursue, Stephen, the issue of, you know, how Pakistani... I know a little bit more about the intellectual and some government people. In all the years, when this question has been broached, what do you think of, you know, Kashmir becoming independent, I have not, maybe two people out of, you know, 40 or 50 that I have known that have been involved in these issues have really cared that much. They just want to see resolved. They're concerned about their internal situation. So, you know, there's a kind of an institutional and, you know, long-term perspective, and there is perhaps, you know, some people, like if you, you know, there's a kind of a goading sometimes too. Well, you know, do you? I think if when they're among themselves and they're talking about these issues, it's a little bit different than perhaps when they talk with, you know, people outside. And I just don't see it. You know, I think that if it's sort of left to its own devices, I think the Pakistani, at least the ones that over the years I've talked to, wouldn't be so upset. They have just so much on their plate in the country. So
I'm a little unclear. Are you talking about Pakistanis, or are you talking about Kashmir? You're talking about how Pakistanis feel about Kashmiri independence, or about how Kashmiris feel about it?
When Pakistanis talk about Kashmir amongst themselves, I think is different than the way the experts, Americans, perceive them to be thinking about it. And I've seen that difference on two or three other issues, and I don't know how you resolve.
Well, I would say that the data do not have an unambiguous direction. They're divided between those who wanted Kashmir to be part of Pakistan or want Kashmir to be independent. So it's not. We're not suggesting that there's some kind of unequivocal position here among the Pakistani people.
No,
you're absolutely right that discussions internal to the Pakistani society are different from discussions with outsiders.
Yes,
and that's to be expected. I think that's true in most countries. I would also say that the attitudes that Steve reported on that showed up in the polling inside Kashmir pretty much match with what conventional wisdom has been among those who have reported on Kashmir, both foreigners and local press. The prevailing analysis has been that Kashmiris' strong preference, and when I say Kashmiris, in this case I'm talking about the residents of the valley, that they would like to be independent.
Oh, yeah, and I thought he was talking about the Pakistanis that he had spoken to.
Yes, but...
Okay, yeah, that's what I was...
Both of those.
But the Pakistani intellectuals, for the most part, are more predisposed to an independent. They don't want it to be part of Pakistan. I have never heard that in the 30 years that this discussion has come up, where the more involved Pakistanis in this issue have said, we want it to be part of Pakistan. There's much more. I totally disagree with that.
Just to clarify, though, about the poll, the poll in all of these countries was not done by Westerners.
Yeah, okay.
These
well,
are
that's
locals
true
that
too.
Come that show up at their door.
Gentleman there in the back of the room. You sir. And the microphone is on its way to you.
Okay. Prakash Kumar, Professor of Modern South Asian History. First of all, let me compliment you for the study, because I think one of the nagging issues with similar studies of Kashmiri issues that people in general and Kashmiri people in particular are just absent from those studies. That said, I would also like to go beyond these studies as to what do these indicate, what are these markers for? And I think one of the comments that came from the commentator was towards this, which is that if you analyze this data of public opinion the variations do not correlate with differences in economic class from which people come, then what else do they indicate? What do they correlate with? I mean, what lies beneath these formed opinions, perceptions, etc.? I mean, one thing which was...
Do you mean in Pakistan, India, or Kashmir?
In all of them, in all of them. And that's how I'm coming to my question. One thing that it correlates with very clearly, as I saw in your data, is that it correlates with the region. I mean, there are physicians in Ladakh, Valley, and Jammu. But there is another thing. I mean, these perceptions are also an outcome of political mobilization and the political affiliation of these people. So if it doesn't correlate with economic classes, then by default, I'm inclined to think it correlates with ideology. These might be ideological positions. And in that context, I mean, one concrete fact that comes to my mind is, you know, the right-wing politics in India and the way L.K. Advani, on one particular occasion, when he decided to hoist the national flag in Srinagar, that had a major impact. And therefore, I would like to know from you if you have any markers towards the fact that these positions are, you know, can be correlated with political mobilization. Because that gives me hope that these positions can change.
Well, just I think you're confusing. I mean, my comments, you know, we've been working with these Pakistan data, you know, for I guess a year as we finalize the survey. My comments about the controlling for the economic issues, that really only pertain to the Pakistan survey. My comments, they don't have the respondent level data for the India data, so there wouldn't be any way of answering the question about
what I can compliment is that as a South Asia historian, I know that these you cannot find correlation with economic classes in India as well. So what I'm suggesting...
None of the literature, by the way. The terrorism insurgency literature is so resoundingly clear. There is no study that says support for these groups is economically driven. It's really robust.
I'll stop short of support for terrorism. I would say support for political positions.
All the literature looking at these political mobilizations across a vast spectrum, I don't know of a single study that shows that there's any evidence that economic deprivation...
And I do not disagree. I think I'm not making myself clear.
I was just clarifying the two surveys. That's all. You just conflated the comments from these two different
surveys. Right. I'm trying to expand beyond that, and I'm saying that can you correlate these public positions or these opinions with the political mobilization that has resulted in these
perceptions? They don't have respondent level data for the Kashmir data, so it may be, but no one at this table has respondent level data for that Kashmir study.
We literally can't answer your question.
Literally.
not for Kashmir.
Lady but, in the purple shirt, you.
Hi, my name is Tara Chandra. Thanks. My name is Tara Chandra. I'm an intern at the Brookings Institution this summer, so I saw the Pakistani foreign minister last week. And seeing these data, I kind of have a question about the extent to which these opinions resonate with the governments of these countries. I mean, you know, it's really interesting to see that the data shows that people in these countries, you know, perceive the other nation or the Kashmir issue as a critical threat, and they see, you know, the role of the U.S. as a certain threat, you know, with regards to the other country. But to what extent, I know you probably don't have data for this, but just, you know, out of curiosity, to what extent do you think that the governments, you know, that these ideas about the threat levels and things resonate with the governments of these countries? Thanks.
I think in general that the Indian and Pakistani governments are influenced by their own threat perceptions. Their practicing politicians, at least the ones in India are and the civilian ones in Pakistan are, they spend time in their constituency. They presumably have some sense of what people worry about and what people hand them little chits about and so on. But I think those are much less poll-driven governments than ours. And I think they also probably have a fairly pronounced skepticism about the validity of poll data as compared to what you can get when you're in your home turf and getting dirt on your chapuns and breathing in the air and so on.
I would only add to that, you know, in Pakistan, I don't really think that this Kashmir issue is even in the portfolio in a meaningful way of the civilians. I mean, this has been the deal from the time Benazir came back that this is an issue that's in the purview of the army. So, you know, to some extent, when we talk about the civilians pursuing their policy, I think that's kind of a canard. And particularly in the post-9/11 environment, I would say the Pakistani security elite have a fairly compelling argument to make that their environment's gotten a lot nastier. The Taliban didn't deliver much, except they kept the Indians out of Afghanistan. You know, there are, if you were to just take the optic of a Pakistani security elite, the neighborhood's gotten a lot worse. Key things that they care about, key promises that probably Musharraf thought he had in hand when he signed up, he signed his wagon up to this alliance, haven't materialized or they've degraded. He wanted to preempt Indo-U.S. relations becoming more robust. Well, that's been obviated by history. He wanted to protect his nuclear assets. Well, to some extent, from their point of view, and we may debate how realistic this is, they see the Indo-U.S. civilian nuke deal as dramatically undermining their current position with their nuclear weapons. He also thought that he was going to secure, you know, better or more intense U.S. involvement on Kashmir. And I think, if anything, the U.S.-Indian relationship has really taken the pressure off of that. So if you're the Army, things have gotten a lot worse. And so if it were possible to pull the folks who are mostly responsible for security in the country, which you can't do, I bet you would see even more insecurity than what the average populace would evidence.
And probably different. Okay, we're starting to run out of room, but this gentleman here and this gentleman here are on my list.
Excuse me. We do have regional data to answer Chris's question, and so if you could just leave us a couple of minutes at the end for that.
Okay.
I have a brief question about the kind of north-south divide that they've been talking about. I'm Sam Black from the Stimson Center. I saw that almost your entire sample, especially in Pakistan but also in India, was taken from urban areas. And I was wondering if you have any other data that would kind of indicate what would happen if you broadened the sample to include more outlying districts and particular areas where there might be refugees from the region.
This is something we've been studying, and we have done some polls in India where we have the rural sample as well as urban sample, and we've looked at the effect of dropping out the rural sample. And you get more don't-know responses in the rural areas, but once you control for those, the effect is rather modest. Of the questions that we have explored, you know, there's always the possibility somewhere there's a question where there's a big variation. And there would be, I think, if you were to ask questions about party affiliation and preference for particular candidates, things like that. But the broader, more value-oriented questions that have to do with the role of the country, the kind of bigger, broader narrative, national narratives, we have not found significant or substantial variations between the urban and rural areas.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Do you believe
that...
Sorry. Babur Khan. I'm also from the Stimson Center. Do you believe that in Pakistan the civil-military views on Kashmir are more or less aligned, or do you believe there is some substantial divide between them?
I'm not sure there's a divide that goes neatly between civilians and military. I would assume that the military views were particularly influenced by their concept of what was good for Pakistani security from a military point of view. I would also assume, and this is based on conversations I've had, but there's nothing resembling a scientific basis for it, that you will find in the military more than among civilians the view that if we settle too cheaply on Kashmir, we will in some sense be devaluing all the sacrifices we have made in several wars and so forth.
Evan Lewis, our colleague, has done some work on regional variation in Pakistan and India on these questions, and so let me... Yes, go ahead.
did have the opportunity to take the Indian data and break it out into a north-south divide, took the cities that were in the north and separated them from the cities in the south. And what was interesting, and this is what we found broadly demographically, was that there's not as much variation amongst demographic groups as in India as you would expect. In fact, I was really surprised that there was very little variation between Hindus and Muslims in India on the issues about security of Muslims in Kashmir, about the security of Muslims in India, India's posture regarding the Kashmir status. I found them to be broadly in agreement with India's position as well as with the Hindus. As for the north-south divide, you are correct that there is a lot less interest in the Kashmir issue. So there were a lot; they were a lot more agnostic in the southern rather than in the northern. But it didn't change their overall attitudes. It just changed their intensity. So whereas the north would have a majority expressing this opinion, only a plurality in the south. But you would still see, in many instances, the same attitudinal profile between the north and the south. There were a couple of exceptions here and there, but for the most part, they were in broad agreement on a variety of issues. In Pakistan, the regional divide was rather interesting, in that you saw a lot more differences when it came to province than you did amongst other demographic variables. Once again, there was occasional differences, but it wasn't consistent abroad other broad demographic categories. But when it came to the issues of Kashmir, the Punjab and the Sindh province were more likely to support harsh actions against India. Punjab province tended to favor a more hardline or a military posture by the Pakistani government, while the Sindhs didn't necessarily support a military posture by the government, but they were more likely to support harsh action against India. And it was expressed most strongly by a willingness to support attacks against certain groups in India. Pluralities and majorities in the Sindh province supported attacks against Indian police, intelligence agents, and the military. While you didn't see that necessarily in other provinces, while in Baluchistan you saw a much more compromising attitude. They wanted to compromise more. They were less militaristic. And when it came to attacks against different groups, in India, they were totally against all of them, large majorities against any kinds of attacks across the board. The Sindh and the Baluchistans are both more likely to support an independent Kashmir, interestingly enough, in part because they believe the Kashmiris want it. The major difference between the two is the attitude about and perceptions that extend to the Pakistani-held parts of Kashmir, where in the Sindh province they were more likely to perceive that the Kashmiris in the Pakistan-controlled area wanted an independent state, while in Baluchistan they didn't.
Well, thank you very much to all of you for joining us. And let's give our speakers a hand.